Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on November 17, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Salata Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
As in all the Buddhist suttas, this sutta, and all the others are taught in the context of dependent origination in the Four Noble Truths. This sutta speaks specifically to what could be a confusing aspect of the Dhamma to many people, of the nature of their own contribution to suffering, and ultimately how that is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And to understand that and bring that contribution, that individual contribution to our own suffering, to cessation, the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, and that Eightfold Path is taught to gain very specific insight, and that is insight into three marks of existence. And the reason why I say that is the word insight is almost as commonly misapplied as the word mindfulness in relation to the Buddha's Dhamma, where insight is insight into everything, and in a sense it is, but as the Buddha teaches that insight into all phenomena, it needs to be very specific into the impermanence of all things in relation to the not-self characteristic or a misunderstanding. When it's focused on simply impermanence without the understanding that your views of self are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, there's no true insight. And the same is true for, as is taught in many commonly, that the only thing we have to understand is that there's no such thing as a self, meaning the insight is into that, and that concept is simply something that the Buddha never taught. He never taught that there's no such thing as a self. He simply taught that the views that we use to reference a self are views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And so again, he taught an Eightfold Path to gain insight into the impermanence of all things, the not-self characteristic, and the resulting confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering, in a word, dukkha, that follows from that misunderstanding. So how's that for an introduction? And I'll skip over the introduction in this article. In the Salata Sutta, a question is put to the Buddha as to what is the distinguishing factor between a well-instructed and well-informed Dhamma practitioner and those that have no understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So this doesn't relate just to people who have no interest at all in Buddhism, in parentheses. And that, in fact, he's teaching this sutta specifically to people that may be developing a so-called spiritual practice, but they are uninformed of the Four Noble Truths. And that is a very common form of modern Buddhism. I'm constantly getting emails and phone calls from online students, and I just got one this week, where this person was astonished that they've been practicing Buddhism for many, many years in many different centers and many different lineages, and no one has ever mentioned the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path. And I found that to be true in the many years that I was studying in different forms of Buddhism. Very, very rarely was the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path even mentioned. And when it was mentioned, it was mentioned that they're anachronisms. They're not relevant to today's Buddhism or today's environment, when this is the only thing that the Buddha taught. The Buddha responds, "Friends, listen closely and pay attention. An ordinary, uninformed person feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, and neutral or ambiguous feelings. One well-informed of the Four Noble Truths also feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, and neutral feelings." This speaks directly to what I just said. Much of spirituality, much of New Age philosophies, much of religion, especially modern Buddhist religions, are presented in a way to escape from suffering or abandon any understanding of suffering. When the Buddha teaches right here and throughout throughout all of his Dhamma teachings, that dukkha is simply to be understood. And as he describes profound right view, awakened right view, that's the first line in there. Dukkha has been understood. And it's through the Eightfold Path that we understand that. So notice, dukkha isn't even presented, or suffering is not presented as something to even overcome. An awakened human being feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, and those ambiguous feelings. The difference, a defining characteristic between someone who has developed the Four Noble Truths and someone who is ignoring the Four Noble Truths, even through their own called modern Buddhist practice, will react to that. And they'll react to it in very interesting ways that I've seen and observed. One of it is this notion that we should embrace our suffering. The very famous worldwide teacher speaks to that, that we should embrace our suffering. What's another word for embrace but clinging to our suffering? And it's creating an objectified and self-referential view of our suffering, because now I've embraced my suffering, rather than recognizing in an impersonal way that suffering arises and passes away, as the Buddha's teaching here. It's one of the reasons why I feel this is one of the most significant suttas, because it speaks very clearly to that common misconception. The Buddha continues, when through the sixth sense base, an uninformed person experiences a feeling of pain, they are sorrowful, they grieve, they become distraught and irate. The uninformed feels two pains, the physical pain of the experience and the mental pain caused by the reaction arising from clinging to views ignorant of Four Noble Truths. This would be like being hit with an arrow and then by request being hit by another arrow, the two arrows. And it's from our ignorance that we do that, that we react to what's occurring to us because we're taking it personally. And this gets to the very subtle teachings of the idea of not self, not no self. I won't get into that today, but the upcoming talks are going to get into that a little bit deeper. It speaks to the reaction caused by taking things personally, including, and most importantly, the aspects of dukkha related to Dhamma practice that are meant to be seen as impersonal, and yet because of a misinformed and misfocused Dhamma practice, we think we're supposed to take these things personal. We're supposed to analyze it. That's another aspect of insight, to analyze our suffering or erase our suffering. The Buddha doesn't teach, he simply teaches to recognize that it arises and passes away. I'm going to skip over a little bit of my commentary because I just gave it. The Buddha continues, as the person is experiencing pain, pain resistance occurs. That's another word for reaction. And once we react to any type of pain, and this isn't just physical pain, we walked into a door, or an emotional pain from an argument, it's any type of reaction to ordinary phenomena arising and passing away, and wanting more or less of the event. That's painful. As a person is experiencing pain, pain resistance occurs, which means if it's something that is giving us pleasure, we start becoming fearful. Remember that the Buddha says desire creates fear. Because we want that third piece of chocolate cake, two pieces isn't enough, but we don't think we're going to get it. We're fearful that we won't get it. We start creating a conditioned aspect of our mind around simple, ordinary events that lead to further conditioning and further distraction. And the same thing happens when something unpleasant happens to us. Because of a misunderstanding and taking it personally, we insist that we should not be having this experience when it's simply an impersonal experience that's part of having a human life. Is that clear? Things arise and pass away. There's nothing personal about them. As the person experiences, leading to resistance, let me read that again to keep it in the right context. As a person is experiencing pain, pain resistance occurred, leading to resistance obsession. Another word for that, for resistance obsession, is a constantly distracted mind. Because then once our mind is conditioned in that way, we're always striving after what will give us pleasure or striving after what we can do to avoid anything that might take away from that pleasure. And that's the ongoing distraction of a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The reason why the Buddha taught Shamatha Vipassana meditation was for deepening concentration and for no other reason, as we learned through those last seven talks on jhana. That's the purpose of meditation, to deepen concentration, which is the antidote to a mind distracted by resistance obsession. As a person experiences pain, delight or obsession in sensual pleasure occurs. Reaction brings obsession as the uninformed does not understand what is actually present, the origination, the allure, the drawback, and the passing away of the feeling. That is all related to impermanence.
Can you read that again?
I'm sure. Sorry. Thank you for asking.
Just the four things that allure was in there too.
Reaction brings obsession as the uninformed does not understand what is actually present, the origination, the allure, the drawback, and the passing away. And so allure is also part of not wanting an experience. It's just the other side of the same coin of clinging. And so this is simply a more elaborate explanation of an experience of an event within impermanence. It arises. We become obsessed with it by clinging to it, by taking it personal. That's the trigger to the allure. We miss the fact that there's a drawback here, whether it's pain or pleasure. Wanting more of something is desire leading to fear. Wanting less of something is desire leading to fear. We miss that drawback because we are obsessed with the reaction rather than noticing the arising, the allure, the drawback, and the passing away. The reason why the Buddha taught the meditation method that he did, as he taught it, as presented in the Satipatthana Sutta and many other suttas, that simple act of being mindful of the breath coming into the body and out of the body, the arising and the passing away of our breath, is the perfect metaphor and, at the same time, the practical experience of all phenomena arising and passing away. And when we utilize any other meditation method or adapt the breath in any other way except as it's occurring, we miss that most important aspect of meditation. And that's the sole reason why the Buddha taught meditation as he did, because it provides the foundation for recognizing just what Jen just asked me to say again, and I'm going to say it one more time. Mm-hmm. From recognizing the origination, the allure, the drawback, and the passing away of all phenomena. It's all encapsulated in that mm-hmm. simple meditation method that the Buddha taught. And when we can bring that type of mindfulness, the true mindfulness, the authentic mindfulness that the Buddha teaches, into every experience, then we are able to see the origination, the allure, the drawback, and the passing away of whatever is occurring in our life. And as we continue to train ourselves, it becomes second nature to know that. And how is that experienced? Just as the Buddha describes an awakened right view. We understand what's occurring. We understand its origination, its allure, its drawback, and its passing away. And that becomes part of our refined mindfulness. Thank you for asking the question. And the passing away of the feeling. As the uninformed does not understand the origination, the allure, the drawback, and the passing away of the feeling, then any ignorance obsession with regards to this feeling of pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, or ambiguity, overcomes and obsesses them. Let me say that again. Any ignorance obsession. So now this, because of all these things are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, it is, in its most profound understanding, an obsession with ignorance. And that's why you hear me say this often, and I don't know that I ever would have recognized it as deeply as I did if I didn't have this, was fortunate enough to have this seat. But the very powerful but very subtle strategies that we all employ to continue to ignore our own ignorance. That's ignorance obsession. And relating it directly to this sutta, that's why people create other dharmas, because it allows for the continuation of ignoring our own ignorance while seemingly engaged in a practice that's supposed to deliver us from ignorance. But when we ignore through that ignorance obsession what the Buddha actually taught and substitute something else, again, that's the essence of the sutta, then all we're doing is continuing with our own ignorance obsession. It feels good. It looks good. We get a lot of other people doing it, and we get to decide what our dharma practice is going to be. Rather than practice, Lorna put it very clearly this morning, commenting on the Madhavabhanga Sutta, it's such a simple and direct sutta that the Buddha describes what to do and also what the experience of developing that practice is. And he continued. And that ignorance obsession overcomes and continues to obsess them. Again, I'm going to skip over some of my commentary. The Buddha continues, sensing pleasure or pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, the uninformed, through self-reference or personalizing the experience, my comment right there, joins with it. And this is how the Buddha often describes the problem of suffering rooted in ignorance, is that we join with our suffering. And how often do we say, Somebody said, how was your day? Oh, I had a bad day. That's joining with our suffering, isn't it? Or when we personalize something, we get into a discussion with someone that's not going the way we want, we take it personally. And we often will blame that person for that's personalizing it. That's what the Buddha is describing. We have now joined with our pain or with our pleasure. Tomorrow morning, I'm getting a new Maserati. I can't wait to get my new car. I've now joined to pain, haven't I? Because at some point, the Maserati is going to run out of, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That's joining with our suffering. Now, if it happens to be that I'm getting a new Maserati, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with the car or getting a car or owning a car. It's self-identifying with the Maserati that's the problem, that it's my car, and it elevates me or establishes me in a certain way. And so by me identifying now as a Maserati owner, I've now tricked myself to enter into a fabricated mind state that the Buddha cautions about over and over again, meaning a non-physical imaginary plane of existence. The Buddha would often reference that in Dharmic terms as establishing ourselves in the dimension of infinite consciousness or the dimension of infinitude or the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. But any establishment in an imaginary realm, such as I have a Maserati, is an imaginary fabricated view of self. And we do that with any type of ideology. The most common and obvious expression of that is the extreme political ideology that people are establishing for themselves. And then by establishing them one way, all the other ideologies are wrong. That's just one example, but we do that with everything. We might do it with the elks or the, you know, I'm an elk, that's who I am. Does everybody understand that when I establish myself as an elk, everybody might not even know what the elks are anymore, a social group, a social organization, that's an imaginary, even if it's true, in my mind, it's an imaginary or non-physical realm that I've established myself in. And because I'm an elk, I'm making a reference to the honeymooners here, so hang on. By establishing myself as an elk, the raccoons are not as good as me.
Okay, you've lost me.
The elks are a common physical and a social group.
Fraternity,
yes,
right.
A better word.
Okay.
And the raccoons are an even more imaginary fraternity that Ralph Cramden and Ed Norton were a part of. Excuse me for going that far.
You don't have your hat, but you must be a member of the raccoons.
Yes. So.
I've been for years.
I'm having some great fun here, but the idea that even though there's a physical reality to being an elk or not really to a raccoon, it's in our minds that we have created the self-establishment, and so it's a non-physical establishment. We do that all the time, and that's Buddha. It's what the Buddha is referring to here, and we do this most importantly to get out of that silliness. We do it. Most importantly, again, this is a teaching on right Dhamma practice, which is a lot of what the Buddha teaches. And so in that essence, it's recognizing the danger of identifying with ourselves and creating these imaginary self-referential non-physical identities in dharmas that have nothing to do with what the Buddha teaches. And the Buddha is not teaching in any way morally that's right or wrong. It's an incredibly and singularly practical teaching. What the Buddha is teaching is that if you want to develop awakening as the Buddha teaches awakening, you have to practice what he teaches. But you also have to recognize and avoid what he doesn't teach. That was common during the Buddha's time, even within the original Sangha, and it continues today. And that's one of the reasons why I keep bringing it up, because I find that the Buddha keeps bringing it up. But I also see it occurring in the world today, in my own experience, in different Dharma practices, but also within our Sangha. The question has arisen from people, and again, it's a completely legitimate question. But I also notice that people that are inclined towards wanting their modern Dharma practice to be an adaptation, accommodation, or embellishment to what the Buddha taught, they usually don't come back here. And that's fine. But to me, if I'm going to teach, and this is something that I came up against many years ago when I first started teaching, and it took me a little bit of time to really come to grips with it, when you start doing something, you want to be successful, don't you? Anything, no matter what it is. And being a meditation teacher, the first thing that you think is important that will prove that you're successful is having hundreds and hundreds of people come and listen to you. That's the trap, and it's a trap that the Buddha recognized. Remember in the Aryaparyasana Sutta, the Buddha was asked by Alarakalama and Udeka Ramaputta, both very well established and famous spiritual teachers, to come and join them and be their number one representative. And the Buddha said, no, I'm not going to do that. Even though great fame and fortune would follow, that doesn't lead to the goal. And he understood at the most compassionate level how cruel it would be to teach something that doesn't lead to understanding and just continues ignorance. And so, again, that's the point of that and what the Buddha is referring to here. The uninformed is joined, he joins with it, joins with suffering. The uninformed is joined to birth, aging, sickness, death, joined to sorrows, grief, pain, and despair. Through reaction to the experience, the uninformed joins with and furthers their confusion and suffering. By joining with it, by doing anything other than dukkha, then using the Eightfold Path to understand it, we further our own suffering and those of others. The well-informed, the Buddha continues, the well-informed person, when stress arises, has no resistance. That's another way of saying that we stay mindfully present with our life as life occurs, the essence of a well-concentrated mind. With no resistance obsession occurs. Another word for that resistance obsession is further continuing our conditioned mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. They feel only one pain, the physical pain, but not mental. Just as if they were shot with an arrow, but not another, they would feel only one pain, the physical pain, the pain that is simply common to having a human life. And even referring to a physical pain, the Buddha is not only talking about feeling something physically, but feeling an emotion within our body. And a good description of an emotion is a feeling that has a judgment attached to it. That would be, the judgment is the reaction. Is that clear? So it's not just physical pain, but the Buddha is referring to that in that way. With no delight or reaction in sensual pleasure, no pleasure obsession occurs. The well-informed person understands what is actually present and understands its origination, its allure, its drawbacks, and its passing away. A well-informed person understands the impermanence inherent in any situation and the impersonal nature of that, the first two marks of existence. And because a well-informed person understands anicca and anatta, impermanence and not self, the views rooted in wrong views rooted in self, no dukkha occurs, no resistance obsession occurs, no ignorance obsession occurs. Do you see how this teaching and all the Dhamma relates to those three marks of existence? Very specifically. So when we get into the weeds of understanding impermanence and all its applications, or establishing a Dhamma practice that is focused only on realizing the nothingness of self, we're completely in the weeds. We're practicing something other than what the Buddha taught, and that's the importance of this. Those well informed do not become sorrowful or regretful or distraught. They remain disciplined from pleasure and pain. They remain calm, just like the pictures we see of the Buddha, no matter what's occurring. And I often say that in this way, that we remain peaceful with less than peaceful mind states. Meaning that no matter what's going on around us, no matter how much chaos and turmoil and conflict might be going on, we maintain this inner composure of an awakened human being. We don't react to it because we understand what's occurring. Once we understand, that's the you could say that everything the Buddha teaches, and these are his words too, is teach to understand the nature of suffering as the Buddha describes suffering. Again, not to escape it, not to manipulate it, not to analyze it, to simply understand. And how do we understand it? By letting go of all wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's the only thing that the Buddha ever taught. The Buddha continues, the well-instructed person, understanding stress, meaning dukkha, does not generate a mental reaction to pain, pleasure, or neither pleasure nor pain. And I would add here, my commentary is, we will not create scenarios or rituals or practices that distract us from understanding suffering. This is a distinction between those uninformed and those well-informed of the Noble Truth. I got to say, the reason why I just said that is I was involved in many different schools, and they teach all types of different ways of dealing with, not really stress, but just, I don't even know how to describe it, to just to establish something else that distracts us from understanding, such as endless chanting or endless rituals, endless bowing, or deity worship, which is a common one, or creating imaginary establishments in non-physical realm. That's what the Buddha is referring to and what I'm referring to. They're simply distractions from understanding dukkha. And it keeps us distracted from the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha continues, a well-instructed person who has developed the heartwood of the Dhamma. When the Buddha uses the word heartwood of the Dhamma, he's always referring to what? The heartwood of the Dhamma is the Eightfold Path. That person understands the arising and the rest of it, allure, the drawbacks, and the passing away of all phenomena, meaning that he understands the three marks of existence. I'm going to read my commentary here. This also relates to right meditation and remaining mindful of the arising and the passing away of the breath and the body. Obsession with what is stressful causes one to become stuck in the feedback loop, in a feedback loop only focused on the arising of the stressful experience. That refers to the Nagara Sutta, and Lorna brought this up a few times. The right meditation, being mindful of the arising and the passing away, is in essence a metaphor and a practical experience, I know I'm saying this twice, of this description of the arising, the allure, the drawback, and the passing away. And it's the reason why whenever we substitute any other meditation method, no matter how common it is or how nice it makes us feel, it's simply a distraction from doing this. And again, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't do other meditation practice, or a lot of what is taught as meditation is really contemplation, if we find benefit in it. But if you're going to do that, don't attach it to your Dhamma practice, because it will simply prove to be more of a distraction. Personally, I wouldn't understand why I wouldn't want to do that, because I want to put all of my meditation time and effort into deepening my concentration and nothing else. I'm going to skip over the rest of my commentary. The Buddha continues, craving and aversion, he was talking about a well-informed Dhamma practitioner, craving and aversion no longer distract the mind or continue ignorance. Craving and aversion in relation to what the Buddha is talking about is wanting the heart riddle of the Dhamma to be any different than it is through craving or aversion to it. Approval and rejection are dismissed. They're no longer in existence. You hear me often say that one of the problems with a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths is we mix up attachment and approval, or not attachment.
Acceptance.
Acceptance and approval, thank you. Because we think that in order for us to accept something, we first have to judge it, evaluate it, approve of it, and then I can accept it. The radical acceptance, as the Buddha teaches, doesn't require approval at all. In fact, it dismisses approval in favor of that radical acceptance, because it's what's occurring, and I no longer need to take it personally. Imagine the peace that would prevail in the world today if we could all practice radical acceptance. There'd be no need for anything else except our mindful presence in the world. Of course, I don't know that that's going to happen. And it's not something that the Buddha taught could happen. Again, he didn't see himself as a savior or teaching a salvific religion. He taught a practice for each and every individual who develops it to end conflict in their own mind. Craving and aversion no longer distract the mind or continue ignorance. Approval and rejection are dismissed, no longer in existence. Now, no dust remains, or sorrow, regret, either. That line, no dust remains, remember in the Arya Parihasana Sutta and many others, I just referenced that because that was last week, that the Buddha was concerned about if he could teach this Dhamma just after his awakening. And he went through this series of thoughts, coming to the final conclusion that there are people in the world that have just a little dust in their eyes, meaning that they're able to see and understand the Dhamma. Those that have too much dust won't be able to. But he realized that because there's a few people in the world with just that little bit of dust in their eyes that can understand the Dhamma, that made it worthwhile to get up off his seat and start teaching, which he did for the next 45 years of his life. And that's what this reference is. And it's an important reference because it brings an understanding to why people might hear the Dhamma and not want to practice it the way the Buddha teaches it, because they have a lot of dust in their eyes. But that's not a permanent state, because the dust can get blown away by the right experiences. So there's no, the reason why I'm saying this, there's no judgment of those that might practice something different. They just have a little bit more dust in their eyes than we do. But that's not a permanent state, isn't it? Because we understand impermanence. But as the Buddha says here, now an awakened one, no dust remains, relating directly to that. Or sorrow or regret either. Imagine living your life without any sorrow or regret about anything. Imagine the peace that you'd have in your mind. Imagine how free you would be of conflict. No sorrow or regret remain. For those that understand the Dhamma, they have left behind becoming further ignorant from views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, my comment there, and have arrived at the far shore of awakening. They have arrived at the far shore of awakening. That's the end of the sutta, by the way. I just wanted to emphasize that. Look at how simply and directly the Buddha describes the difference between those of uninformed of his Dhamma and those well-informed. They have developed a calm and peaceful mind. No sorrow or regret remain. It's so simple, isn't it? And it's attainable, isn't it? Would everybody here agree that that is at least attainable? To find a place within us where there's no conflict anymore? That's the purpose of the Buddha's Dhamma. There's nothing, again, nothing ambiguous about it. There's nothing that we can't develop within ourselves, provided that we recognize the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma. And we do that by not adapting, accommodating, or embellishing it anyway. That's the importance of this sutta on the two arrows. And another, and getting back to the visual, that when we insist on not practicing the simple and direct path that an awakened human being taught, we are doing it because we insist on sticking the second arrow in us. Because we're not satisfied that this is enough. And how does the Buddha teach to get to that point, to know that it's enough? You can answer if you know. You do know. Through direct experience, it's the only way. And he says that repeatedly. And through that direct experience, if we do it wholeheartedly, we will very quickly recognize the efficacy of the Eightfold Path. But, and this is why I referenced earlier this understanding that I see it at a much deeper level now, the very powerful and subtle strategies that we'll create to ignore our own ignorance, because I see it within the Buddha's Dhamma, or I should say within Buddhism in general. And I was caught up in it for many years. I was enamored with it for many years, but it ultimately it got me nowhere and I became frustrated with it. And it wasn't until I came back to practice and now teach only what I can find in the Sutta Pitakas, the Sutta Pitaka, that it made all the difference in the world. And it made sense to me. You know, for all those other years, nothing really made sense. I was doing something and I created an identity and an establishment in a non-physical realm by it, but I didn't know what I was doing. And because I didn't really have any direct experience of anything truly valuable, it led to more frustration and more confusion that I applied to myself, because that's often how, as it's taught too. If you don't get this, don't worry about it, because you can't get it. It will take endless eons to get it. But in the moment, this is what you need to do, which was something contrary to what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught that you know it by direct experience. Just much like he taught jhana, it's important to understand those teachings on jhana, because their teachings on recognizing that our meditation practice is actually bearing fruit. And how do we know? Because our concentration is deepening. If it's not, we know that we're doing something that's not what the Buddha taught. So that's my talk for today. Just give me a moment. There's one person who has joined us. I'm not sure if this is going to work, but I'm going to invite them online. Let me do that. Oh, it's Mary. Hi, Mary. I'm glad you joined us. You can send a chat if you want, and I'm going to try to invite you on screen if this works, and if you want to, if your camera's on and your microphone. So, okay, that's not going to work.
Yeah, my micro, can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I can. Hi, Mary.
Yeah, I choose not to have the camera on.
Well, I'm so glad you're able to join us. This is only the second time I'm using this platform, so I came through loud and clear.
Yeah, and if I can figure it out, anybody can figure it out.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad you joined us. So, do you have any question or comment on today's sutta?
No, it was very straightforward and meaningful, and a lot to take in, but it all makes sense.
Yeah, well, that's great. I'm so glad you were able to join us and that it worked. So we'll go around the room and see how others did with the sutta. But I'm so glad you joined us today, Mary. Lorna, good morning.
Good morning. Again, a wonderful sutta. Covers an awful lot of material.
Yeah.
This sutta, perhaps more than some others, you really focus or see your own veil of looking at life through incorrectly, you know, and you just wish you could pierce through that veil and experience what we should be, how we should be experiencing life to learn it.
Yeah.
You know, this sutta sort of speaks to the explanation of what life would be like without our referential views of that we hold about ourselves, etc. And it just teases you to look at, you wonder what that, get rid of that veil, and what life would be like for the Buddha when you awaken, etc.
Yeah.
And so it's really, as I say, teasing is a good word, really. You just look at it and wonder. You know, the homework is to not get caught up in your own views. Realize it's just a thought, it doesn't exist, it's a fabrication, it's a et cetera, all the things that we do look at and we try to dismiss in our meditation.
Yeah.
You know, it's just another wonderful teaching. The explanation which Jen pointed out, that there's four syllables, you know, looking at your own, the Buddha meticulously describes our thinking in so many ways, so many times, and you think, blimey, how did he know that? You know, it must have been so concentrated himself.
Yeah.
For him to understand his own thinking and see it in others as he did.
Yeah.
It
That's
really
right.
is quite remarkable. Yeah. And I say, you could say that about every sutta, every week.
Yeah.
And this is no exception. It's just truly remarkable. And the point of the sutta is to see the two arrows, you know, how the reaction that we have to phenomena, good or bad, or wanting it, not wanting it, wanting a bit different, wanting it more, wanting it red when it's blue, whatever, wanting a Ferrari, when you get a Maserati, whatever. Well,
yeah.
I would have a Ferrari.
I'll take,
anyway,
I'll
so, you know, you're getting the wrong car right there, so, et cetera, et cetera.
That's just how Ferrari owners would see Maserati.
Yes. you know, and just the whole nonsense of it is quite straightforward and plain, and that's the world we live in, and we just wish we could just drop it, step through that veil and be content with life forevermore.
Yeah.
Enchanting thought. Thank you.
Wow, thank you. Yeah, dropping that rock of self-referential views, and then everything is meaningful,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a Ferrari or a Dodge Dart. I used to have a Dodge Dart too. You know, it just doesn't matter. You know, none of it really matters. Meaning, outside us,
mm-hmm.
if we do have that mind free of conflict, the calm and peaceful mind. And it doesn't mean that we'll be disengaged from the world in a practical sense. In fact, the Buddha's own life teaches that. He developed this mind, this, because of his own brilliance, free of conflict. And yet when conflict arose, whether it was from a local conflict or something on a regional scale, people went to this man free of conflict and said, what should we do? And he was able to contribute to a lessening of the conflict in the world around him in a way that has not been seen yet. You know, we still don't know how to do it, how to do what the Buddha did. Thank you.
I'm working on it, though.
We are. Yeah. Again, that's the way to work on it, individually.
Before Christmas, I'll tell you.
I think it will. In your case, it will be. Thank you, Laura. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. Good to see everyone. It was a really great talk.
Mm-hmm.
It's making me think, like, when you think about what the happiest moments are in someone's life, it isn't the vacation or the car. It's really generally a momentary connection with another human being that's completely stripped of circumstances and material wealth or anything like that. I love the analogy between the breath and the passing of thoughts. I never thought about it that way before. I mean, it's brilliant if the Buddha actually conceived of that, but also to choose the breath is great in another sense, because every other thing you can meditate on comes and goes, but the breath is always there.
Yep.
And we can't control it. It's involuntary, because if we could, we would have all died a long time ago. You know, so it's brilliant in that sense too. But I did struggle a little bit with a concept in my mind. I generally agree with everything, but do you think that in some cases, if somebody is profoundly judgmental of themselves or harsh on themselves, that you might need a dose of the opposite? Like, you know, I think there's a place for positive psychology in a way, because if you really hate yourself, you need to love yourself to be able to accept yourself.
Well, what a great question, Anthony. And so I won't answer in an absolute by saying no, but fully developing the Eightfold Path in the way that the Buddha teaches it directly addresses that in meditation and in the other teachings of the Eightfold Path, particularly right speech. So right speech is not just what we're saying to others, it's what we're saying to ourselves, and really and ultimately most importantly what we're saying to ourselves. And as our minds become more concentrated, we should be able to recognize that self-hatred. In fact, there's one of a long-running article that it's very hard for me to get it the way I want it, is this an underlying aspect of a mind rooted in ignorance is self-loathing, because we are never enough for ourselves. And whether it manifests to an extreme level or at the very subtle levels, that's really where that self-loathing lies. We're never good enough. And it's not in relation to the world. We're never good enough for ourselves. And so the Dhamma takes us to that level. Now, but again, I won't say in absolute that someone who is so full of self-loathing that the Dhamma itself would be enough. There may be outside forces, but the difficulty, and we do have a couple of therapists to come here, and it might be an interesting discussion to have one day. The difficulty is creating another self-identity as a person who is stuck in self-loathing and needs something else. And so you continually get stuck in that. And the antidote, meaning something outside of the Dhamma, because you've now created a non-physical establishment of yourself in that type of thinking. But it's a very important question. And I'll finish the answer this way from my own point of view and from people that I've worked with, and I've had, I just want to be careful how I say this. I've had some students, not necessarily in the Sangha, and that's important to say, who had very, very deep psychosis to the point where they were a danger to themselves and others. When I encounter someone like that, the first thing I do tell them is to find someone locally, a therapist who's qualified to, and talk to them. just to give them an establishment. But I can tell you that as they developed the Dhamma, that type of self-loathing eventually fell away. So again, it's, and I'm not, I got to be careful too, because a lot of people hear this. I'm not saying that if you have that type of difficulty to drop all of that and just take to the Dhamma, but to answer the question, I've seen it work remarkably well. And I can tell you from my own experience, I don't know that I was ever pathological about my self-loathing, although you might say that active addiction is kind of pathological. But by developing the Dhamma, that self-loathing is no longer in existence, at least as far as I can see. It's not there. So it's a great question. And I think it's an important one to understand.
Yeah, Dr. Claire Weeks, she's like the pioneer of anxiety, and her whole theory was to lean into it and almost embrace the anxiety, because what causes it for a lot of people is running away from it.
Yeah, but that, again, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but because that relates directly to what is that running away from it? It's aversion. Mm-hmm. And so if that is something that is directly addressed through an authentic Dhamma practice, is recognizing the aversion. That's a great example too, that clinical anxiety is an extreme self-referential view, isn't it? And every thought is self-directed. It's at you. Everything is happening to me. I was diagnosed many, many years ago. And this was, I was 26, just coming out of my addiction, and that was common, with social anxiety disorder. And I was put on 9 different medications at one time. I was walking around like a zombie. And it wasn't until I stopped all of the medication first, and realistically for myself, and I also stopped therapy, and I started developing the Dhamma. And I never had to go back to that. And again, I'm not saying people on medication stop your medication, but in my personal experience. So I understand what you're saying, and it may be useful for some people, but I would hope eventually you get to the point where you recognize that any type of those mental difficulties can be addressed through the Eightfold Path. That's not necessarily, you know, I won't say that everybody should and could, but it can. So
a good way to go.
Yeah, and again, I would say that if you're at all in a danger to yourself or to others in any way, to first find a good therapist, and you might ask them, an important question: what do you think about mindfulness? Because there's a lot of therapists that, in general, incorporate some type of mindfulness into their practice, and that's a good one to go to. It might not necessarily be the mindfulness that the Buddha teaches, but at that point it's not important. So I guess what I'm saying, it's important for you to first save your life, and then you can save your mind after that's established.
Yeah.
So thank you for bringing that up. So important.
Thanks for the great talk.
Oh, thank you. Jen, good to see you.
Good to see you. So just to address something you were just talking about is when you were saying that, talking about self-loathing, I mean, I feel like that would just be a hindrance, because it's really ill will for yourself.
It is.
Right? So that's an interesting way to look at it. This was a great, I just really got a lot out of this talk. I was, I felt like it pointed out the problem, but it also provided the solution all in the same package.
Yeah.
And you know, you were talking about having a goal. At one point you mentioned when you have a goal, and that resonated with me right now. So like, you know, I have this goal that I want to achieve. Just even having that goal, immediately I'm like, okay, this is by nature going to cause stress, because I can't get attached to this outcome. I have to like just continue to make the choice as my life progresses, to whatever comes up, whatever phenomenon arises in each moment, choose to respond in a way that will get me closer to that goal if in that moment that's still the goal that I want.
Yeah.
And it's like a big, huge difference then, because if you're attached to an outcome, if you need it to become a certain way in order for your happiness, you've already projected yourself into the future,
yeah.
And you've already...
You're out of your body.
You're out of your body,
yeah.
And you every phenomenon, therefore, that arises becomes a challenge to that outcome.
Yeah.
And, whew, man, so now you just have to, like, I just have to say, every time a phenomenon arises that may affect that outcome, watch the allure, watch the
drawback.
Watch the phenomenon, watch your reaction to it, let it arise and pass away.
Yeah.
And then...
And there's no obsession with it then, is there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Ignorance,
just like the Buddha.
Obsession was like a huge...
Yeah.
We are definitely obsessed with, like, ignoring the reality that this goal hasn't happened yet and it might never happen.
But you're still engaged in the steps needed to achieve the goal.
Right.
You're just
right.
Not personalizing.
But you're
that,
not
that's such
like
an important,
wound up about it.
Yeah. So people get another misunderstanding that if you depersonalize things, where's the motivation to move towards a goal? It's still there, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just not causing stress.
Yeah.
That's the difference. And it's this subtle and profound difference between what the Buddha taught and everything else, because you understand stress.
Mm-hmm.
And when you understand it, you don't create it. That's all.
You don't add to
but
it.
That's everything, isn't it?
Jen's right. It's people think that if you meditate and practice Buddhism, that you're going to lose your drive.
Right.
You won't
do it this way,
to succeed.
Yeah. And it's just the opposite. And, you know, think about
more focused,
the founder did just this, and we're still using his teachings 2,600 years later. Not many of us. Thank you, Jen. Lisa, good to see you. Good morning.
Good to see you too, John, and everyone here. When I realized it was the two arrows, I said to Jen, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Because everybody does, you know, everybody does that.
Yeah.
Attach themselves to this event. But it could be positive, negative, it could be anything. Not necessarily, you know, the arrow's hurting.
Oh, yeah.
But in a way, if it's a positive event, it will become, if you attach yourself to it, it'll become an arrow.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't. So it's a good analogy that with the arrow could be, doesn't have to be a painful.
Yeah.
Great thing.
Because of that pleasure obsession.
Right.
Yeah.
Just, you know, you want to hold on to it. Well, something happened yesterday. It's very minor, but the way I am, I could have blown it all out of proportion. I was picking out a dish to put some grapes in that I was going to ask my daughter if she wanted some of these, some grapes. And I picked one pretty little dish that one year, and maybe I was in my 20s or something, but I remember being over at my mom's and she had like a whole box of these. She said, I'm giving these out this year for in December, winter holidays, you know. And just love these little dishes. Anybody can use a little dish. And I said, oh, that's nice. And she said, and here's one for you. So everybody knows where this is going. So I've had it a long time. It's special to me. I dropped it and it broke.
Dukkha occurred.
Impermanence.
There it was on the floor of the kitchen. And not just So first I thought, well, it's just a few pieces, but it didn't. It was, you know, shards. And, you know, I got the dustpan and brush, and I kind of busied myself just wiping and making sure that I got everything, you know. And then I went to, you know, dump it in the trash. Okay, I can do that. Then I spent some time doing that. Then I picked out another one, put the grapes in, and whatever. And I really, you know, I didn't even feel that bad about it happening. Like I had it all those years, and I can go on with my life without that dish. Even though it was special, and my mom, and she, you know, died a long time ago and everything, and it was okay, because there would be times in my life when I would just freak out, and I didn't, so I didn't let the other arrow happen. At least not yet. I don't know what happened.
Thank you. It's such a good example.
Over by now.
Yeah, you didn't lose your mind. That, you know, that's the essence of mindfulness rooted in concentration. Things occur, you know, and in what would otherwise be a very personal experience, you didn't have yourself attached to it. And there's such a beautiful description of how this works. You know, practical.
And what you just said about, I didn't lose my mind. So this, the whole thing with mindfulness is not emptying your mind. That's mindlessness.
That's mindlessness, yeah.
Using your mind.
Yep.
And our minds are full. You know, there's like a zillion things, you know, we're always complaining about that going on, and that, you know, the chatter and everything. And but you say it's okay, let's go back to our breath.
Yeah, a well concentrated,
all that's going on.
A well concentrated mind sees things as they arise, the allure, the drawback, and the passing away, without personalizing it. So there's no reaction to the mind. What would be the value, think about this, of calling something enlightenment when it's actually just a trance-like state that isn't present with life as life occurs? That's how a lot of modern practices are taught, to develop that. They're taught to establish yourself in the non-physical realm of nothingness or emptiness. And that's just a denial of everything the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught a Dhamma that unites the mind and the body moment by moment as life occurs, period. Mm-hmm. Without any need for anything to be any different than it is. It also means that on a very profound level, we think what's appropriate, but because we're thinking what's appropriate, we're feeling what's appropriate. And what might be appropriate in the moment might be great sadness, or great joy, or great excitement. But there's no self-reference, so it simply flows. We don't create more conditioned thinking out of it. And so just like that, I'm sure when the plate hit the floor, you were unhappy, you were disappointed that it happened. But you didn't need it to be any different than it is. You didn't have to imagine, well, what did I do wrong? Why, how could this happen? How am I going to live without it? It's just a broken dish, you know? So.
You know what you said about the difference of this, like a trance-like state, and the differences between this and, you know, other things about which would be kind of losing yourself
mm-hmm.
in that state. To me, the profound difference is that what we do is just a little microcosm to take it out into the real world.
Exactly, yeah.
And that you can't like go out in the real world in a trance-like state. That doesn't work.
It doesn't.
It doesn't. That doesn't work. Okay, so what you're doing, or making yourself feel and losing yourself and all that, oh, that might be okay for just then. I don't know. But we're doing something where
That's it.
You do it here, and then it's adaptable to real life.
Thank you for saying that. That really, you said it better than I ever had. Mm-hmm. That we take what we develop on our cushion, a well-concentrated mind, out into the world, and it changes everything. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Jay, good to see you today. How are you?
Good to see everybody. And, I was sitting reading a book in the other room when I heard the dish drop. And then I heard, shit.
Oh, I forgot.
Which is okay.
Sure it is.
And I was waiting for the other shoe to drop, but she seemed to have taken it well. The cat didn't mind. He's been getting his food in that dish, I think, if it's the one I'm thinking of. At any rate, John, I have to say, you're really putting the balls right in the strike zone today. I think everybody kind of realized you're on top of your game today and made things quite accessible that might not be otherwise. I guess I simplify things. To me, in my mind, I guess I was sitting here thinking, well, we all know we're screwed, and get used to it.
That's one way of putting it.
Things. The one other thing that you mentioned that got my attention was about the paradox that Buddha has arrived. He knows where it's at. He's sitting there, and everything is, water over the back or whatever. But if you, the paradox is, that's not the nature of reality. There's somebody going to come and agitate him and say, King, what's his name, wants you to come teach and, bring dukkha into his life. How could it be otherwise? He knows better, but he still, can deal with it. And the last comment I just want to make is that I really do enjoy that you go to source material without interpreting it, because you can go to, school, in elementary school, junior high, and hear about what Columbus did. And it's a bunch of twaddle, mainly. But you can also pick up Columbus's logbook. It's around. You can go to the local bookstore and see what the heck he really had on his mind.
Yeah.
So I always have liked, going to source material and not going to things five stages down the line, or, you go in a gift shop, what do you see? The Buddha with the fat belly and his arms are up in the air and he's all giggly at everything. And maybe the Dhamma at some point is funny, but that's interpreted down the line.
Yeah. It is, Thank you for your kind words. And it really is, it just makes sense too, doesn't it? Why don't you go to the source? And that picture of a big fat Buddha lost in his own ridiculousness. He lived on one bowl of alms, one bowl of given food, so he certainly wasn't getting fat. He must have been a very thin man even throughout his life. It's a great class, it's a great sutta. I consider myself so fortunate to be in the position that I am, to be able to teach it. And that means I recognize how fortunate I am, and we all are, that these teachings are still here and they're still available. And so why not teach an authentic Dhamma? And Mary, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have any other questions or comments?
No, I'm good.
Okay, good. Again, I'm glad you joined us, but please don't make a habit of this. We'd like you here.
Yeah.
Good.
I'll do my best.
Great. Thank you, Mary. And just to remind everyone, our Dhamma dinner is Tuesday. I hope you're going to join us, Mary, at the Love and Oven. Begins at 6. There's info on the website. We're going to have our class next week. Our Tuesday class will be on Monday because of the Dhamma dinner, and then we'll have our Saturday class after that, the Saturday after Thanksgiving. And then in two Saturdays, on December 1st, will be our last class here. We're going to have a little ceremony after the class, and who's ever here, if they can hang out and help us move some stuff out, that'd be great. And then the following Tuesday, our first class will be down the street at Healing Path Acupuncture.
Where's that?
Right down here. No. You'll see it on the way out.
Oh, on the same street here?
Yep, number 207 Harrison Street. It's where Matt's acupuncture clinic. Michael wants to use this room for something. I'm not quite sure what's going on with it, but it's time to move on. Impermanence even affects us. But it's a wonderful space down there. It's a little bit smaller than this, but there's parking on site. It's not up a flight of stairs, which is good for me. It's a very pleasant place, so... that'll be December 1st is our last class here. Please come to the Dhamma dinner. Please come to Monday night's class. And I think unless there's any questions or comments, we'll finish with metta as we always do. Okay. And again, Mary, thank you for joining us. Someone's out there?
Yeah, somebody's sitting out there.
I maybe it's for Qigong.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Is Qigong today?
Yeah.
I did text Matt, so I'll check it.
So the landlord probably will charge more because of all the good vibration that he created in the room over the years.
Definitely. Okay, we'll finish with metta as we always do. So find your meditation posture and become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body, your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the words of the Buddha from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Bye,
we'll see
Mary.
You soon.
Bye.
Yeah, actually, I'm heading out to California, so I'll be away for a little bit.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.